growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the US and the UK. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision-making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Kalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran has officially launched its vaccination program, with the son of Iran's health minister being the first Iranian volunteer to receive the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Doctors, nurses, and medical workers there received the first doses of Russian vaccine. Speaking at a ceremony at Imam Khomeini Hospital, Iran's health minister said Iran has chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines.
We have chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines after assessing the most credible vaccines available. Iran insisted from the very beginning that it imports a vaccine only if it has already undertaken the third phase of its human trial, while some of the regional countries did not do so.
In a video address, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani said the vaccination campaign will ensure health of those who receive it.
The fact that the son of the health minister has become a volunteer to receive the first vaccine sends out this message that if officials make decisions about a vaccine and the health ministry approves it, we are all ready to receive it. People should be assured that if a vaccine is imported to the country, all officials trust it. We hope this vaccination campaign will ensure the health of all those who receive imported and domestically made vaccines so that we can take a big step in the fight against COVID-19.
Iran received the first vaccine shipment containing 500,000 doses last week from Russia. It is planned to receive a total of 2 million doses of Sputnik V by the end of March.
The top priority groups of people for vaccination are doctors, nurses, and other medical staff working at intensive care units in hospitals. People over 65 and those with chronic diseases will be amongst the second group of people to be vaccinated. The vaccination of doctors and medical personnel is expected to be complete in less than 2 months.
Iran's vaccination campaign comes as the country is working on its two domestically produced vaccines, namely Covid-1 and Razi-Covpars, which are at the stage of human trials.
According to Iran's health ministry, the national vaccination program in the country will be completed until the end of the next Iranian calendar year. Saman Kujur, Tehran.
In a press conference, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok announced a major cabinet reshuffle, adding that the new cabinet will focus on economic reforms, peace building, balanced foreign policy, restoration of civilian and military entities, and justice for victims of civil wars in the country.
اتفقنا عليهم.
Our government focuses on a number of issues, particularly economy. We have a unified vision in coping with the current economic crisis. We will work hard to implement Juba peace agreement.
The reshuffle is a part of the government's larger plan to push through the reforms and get foreign finance to overcome an ongoing economic crisis. It follows a peace deal signed in October with some rebel groups. Fighting in Darfur has left at least 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced since 2003. Regarding foreign relations, Hamadouk said Sudan's relation will be based on mutual interest, adding that most issues, including relations with Israel, will be decided by the next legislative assembly.
We repeat once again that the issue of normalizing ties with Israel will be decided by the upcoming legislative assembly, and it will decide to accept or reject it.
The reshuffle has created mixed reactions among the public, with many expecting new ways to overcome the current problems.
The ministerial reshaping has been overwhelmed by complacencies. The new ministers are activists with no deep experience. Plus comes as the economic situation is very bad.
This government has done nothing. We want a better government that provides us with better services. I'm struggling with poverty and I can't meet my needs.
Sudan's economy was destroyed under previous regime by decades of sanctions, mismanagement and civil war.
Sudan's Prime Minister has finally made the long-awaited cabinet reshuffle. But the question is, to what extent the new government will be able to address the chronic economic situation and to improve the living condition of Sudanese people? Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Russia has warned that it's ready to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits Moscow with new economic sanctions. The EU reportedly plans to impose travel bans and asset freezes on allies of the Russian president in response to the last week expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats from Moscow. Tensions have risen recently over the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Moscow says the West is exploiting Navalny's case for political reasons. The latest differences between Moscow and the EU could put pressure on the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline being built from Russia to Germany. The United States has also imposed sanctions on companies working on the project. Once completed, Nord Stream 2 would double the flow of energy resources between Russia and Germany.
Russia and the EU have remained at odds over a host of issues for years. Tensions, however, between the two have escalated recently over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and his ensuing imprisonment for violating a parole. Navalny's arrest upon his return from Germany sparked angry reactions in Europe and at home, with thousands of his supporters taking to the streets across Russia. Moscow slammed the rallies as illegal and expelled three European diplomats for attending the rallies. Russia says Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. However, Russia's move prompted tit-for-tat expulsions from Germany, Poland, and Sweden. And the EU foreign policy chief has called for a new round of sanctions on Russia.
First, we will discuss this issue at the Foreign Affairs Council on the next 22nd of February, at the European Union Council in March, This will provide guidance on the way forward, and it will be for the member states to decide the next step. But yes, this could include sanctions.
Russia has reacted strongly to the EU's call, saying it is ready to sever ties with the bloc if it goes ahead with its economic sanctions plan. The Kremlin says it doesn't want to isolate itself, but it has to be ready for the worst-case scenario.
We assume that we are ready to sever ties in case we see again, as we have felt more already, that sanctions create risks for our economy are imposed in most vulnerable areas. Yes, if you want peace, prepare for war.
The Navalny case is just a tip of the iceberg in sinking relations between Moscow and Brussels. Among other things, they have been widely at odds over Russia's support for anti-government forces in eastern Ukraine and reunification of the strategic Black Sea peninsula of Crimea with Russia. Several European countries and the United States have accused Russia of blocking any solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Russia, however, blames Ukraine for failing to implement the 2015 Minsk Agreement that was aimed at putting an end to the conflict. It seems that a current diplomatic spat could be counterproductive for both Russia and Europe, as the two need each other for trade, particularly natural gas. Moscow is building a new pipeline that would bring gas to several European countries, undercutting Ukraine as a transit country. As expected, the U.S. is opposed to the project, claiming it will increase the bloc's energy reliance on Russia. Washington has imposed several rounds of sanctions on the companies involved in the construction of the project. Germany, which has always resisted a direct confrontation with Russia, has fought hard to keep the pipeline going, saying it is a commercial, not a political issue. Despite increasing tensions between the EU and Russia, many European leaders have already signaled they are not quite interested to see a deepening of a standoff with Moscow. It remains to be seen if tensions could spiral out of control as the new US administration and some of its European allies seem hell-bent on declaring Russia as a major challenge.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have historian, journalist, and author Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, we have research fellow at American University in Moscow, Gilbert Doctorow, joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Dr. Papadopoulos. Strong words from the Russian foreign minister, who says that Moscow should be prepared for the worst. Now, just recently, Sergei Lavrov said that the EU is not a reliable partner, at least at the current stage. Where is this heading? In your opinion, is this a new low for Russia-EU ties?
Well, when Britain departed from the European Union, there was a chance, albeit a slim one, that relations between the EU and Russia could improve. Why? Because when Britain had been a member of the EU, the British had constantly pressurized Germany and France, which are the engines of the European Union, to adopt a severe stance on Russia. In plain terms, we can say that when Britain had been a member of the European Union, the British were lobbying very hard on behalf of American objectives in the EU. Now, since Britain has left the EU, the decisions of the European Union vis-a-vis Russia have hardly been conducive to improving relations between Brussels and Moscow. And indeed, the focal point at the moment concerns the EU stance, completely unreasonable, unsubstantiated stance on Alexei Navalny. Now, we have to ask, why is that? The European Union, as it stands today, is at its most fragile, politically and economically. And it is certainly not in the interests of the overwhelming majority of EU member states, with the notable exception, of course, of Poland and the Baltic states, for relations between the economic bloc and the Russian Federation to deteriorate even further. However, it certainly is in the interests of the Americans and the British for relations between the EU and Russia to deteriorate even further. Ultimately, the European Union is a strategic ally to America. The European Union coordinates its foreign policy and its defense policy with America, so much so that we can argue persuasively that America is the outside dominant force in the European Union. So it is, in my estimation, that the Americans and the British have exploited the incident concerning Alexei Navalny to bring about a further worsening of relations between the European Union and Russia, because Washington and London do not want an improvement in relations between the EU and Russia.
Right. Let's cross over to Brussels now, Mr. Dugtaro. Last week, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said that his meeting with Foreign Minister Lavrov highlighted that Europe and Russia are drifting apart, and that it seems that Russia is progressively disconnecting itself from Europe. Do you think that there's any place for constructive dialogue at the current moment right now?
I think what's needed is shock therapy. And this is exactly what Lavrov's words were meant to do yesterday. Just let's keep in mind that Mr. Lavrov is a very capable and very seasoned diplomat at global level. At the same time, the direction of his actions, the directions of his words, are given by Mr. Putin. And behind his remarks about preparing for war, if you want to have peace, we can see very clearly the thinking and the direction of Vladimir Putin. The point here is that Russia and the EU have been drifting apart for the last 10 years. Going back to 2012, when the European Union declined to renew its overall cooperation and strategic partnership with Russia, there has been a downward movement. It's lurched at various points. Of course, the 2014 events in Crimea and the Ukrainian civil war were one important turning point, or I should say lurch, backwards in the relationship. But there have been others. The Skripal poisoning was one. The MH17 was one. And they all have something in common. And that something in common, and here's why I differ a bit with the previous speaker, is a script written in Washington. If the UK has been the voice of skepticism, if not hostility to Russia within the EU, that was all acting in a nod and a wink with what it was receiving by way of recommendations from Washington. The Poland and the Baltic states are the cat's paw of the United States within the EU, and they are effective precisely because the way it is structured today, the EU cannot have a foreign policy that is worth anything. Everything must be based on consensus. Any naysayer can destroy that consensus and deprive the EU of a policy. We are in a situation where these Baltic states and Poland are depriving the major powers in Europe of logical, reasonable relations with Russia. At the same time, Mrs. Merkel is not an innocent bystander in this. Germany has had its own very clear interests as a major power in Mitteleuropa, as where German industry is heavily installed ever since these countries became free of the East Bloc. And Germany is in a love affair with these countries and does not find it very simpatico, very, very easy to deal with Russia. Russia is too big, Russia is too strong. And so it is very easy for Mrs. Merkel and her party and Germany to stand aside and let the Poles and the Baltics do all the nasty words about Russia and appear to be calm and reasonable. Germany is not being calm and reasonable. Its present policy of encouraging Mr. Navalny, of giving him all support when he made his fake news video during his stay in Germany, this is not the act of a friendly power or even a neutral power. It's the act of a hostile power.
Okay.
So Germany has also become an active contributor to the deterioration in relations with Russia.
Back to London, Dr. Papadopoulos. Following the expulsion of the three European diplomats, the EU has hinted at imposing new sanctions against Moscow. Of course, that's a decision that needs to be approved by European governments. How do you view that approach from Brussels?
Well, I believe that threat from the European Union actually originates in Washington. Because as I said moments ago, the European Union, even before what is known as COVID-19, was in an economically precarious condition. And relations with Russia. Trade relations, investment relations are very important to the European Union. It is simply not conducive to the economic well-being of the European Union for there to be EU sanctions on Russia, which stem from 2014, when the European Union, in tandem with America and Britain, initiated and implemented a coup against the then Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. And as a result of the EU sanctions on the Russian Federation, many jobs and companies in the European Union, for example in Spain and Italy and Greece, have been seriously jeopardized because they're no longer able to export to the European Union. So if we speed forward to 2021, how on earth is it in the interest for ordinary people, ordinary companies in the European Union, for the EU to place further sanctions on Russia? Because that will mean that agricultural companies in the EU will be even more impeded in their ability to export to the European Union. So that is why my submission is that behind the EU's threats stands America and also Britain. Of course, Poland and the Baltic states are enjoying the deterioration in relations between Brussels and Moscow because the Baltic states and Poland are vehemently anti-Russian and are doing all within their means to act as a conduit for Western aggression against Russia. Let us not forget that last summer, when the West attempted to engineer a coup in Belarus, or Belarus, that is, as it is officially known as, Poland and the Baltic states acted as the logistical countries in that attempted coup. So the European Union is not truly an independent or sovereign economic bloc. Ultimately, it bends to the will of the Americans.
Same question to Gilbert Dottaro. Have European sanctions been working on Russia?
Well, let's be very clear, because this has not come out in the discussion till now. Mr. Lavrov's statement was explicit. He was not speaking about just any sanctions. He was speaking about sanctions that threaten the vital economic interests of Russia. Now, what does that mean? We don't have to guess. There are two sanctions which could threaten the economic well-being of Russia, and they are first pulling the plug on SWIFT, kicking Russia out of SWIFT, the International Settlement Organization for financial transactions, and the second is putting a halt, if not permanently stopping, the Nord Stream 2 project. The Nord Stream 2 project is the lesser of these two threats to Russia, but it's also very significant. And I'd like to make a small correction to the remarks at the introduction to this program. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline is not going to give additional gas to Europe. It will replace pipelines which have been through Ukraine, which are a means for the United States to threaten European gas supplies and Russian ability to deliver gas at any moment. So it is providing, the Nord Stream 2 would provide a reliable transit of gas to Europe. But coming back to SWIFT, that would be a deadly threat to the Russian economy, and in Iran, you certainly know what this means. Unlike Iran, which did not have the capability of doing damage to those who were imposing the sanctions on it, since petroleum is not as vital or as limited in its supply and in its transport as gas is, Iran did not have a leverage that the Russians have. If the Europe were to implement what was called 2 years ago the nuclear option, that is, throwing Russia out of SWIFT and doing vast damage to the Russian economy, the Russians could do vast damage to the European economy on 2 minutes' notice by stopping the shipment of all gas to Western Europe. If they did that in the middle of Europe, in the middle of the European winter, then all hell would break loose here. So I think that by speaking as he did yesterday about cutting relations, what exactly does that mean? Does it just mean throwing out diplomats, or does it mean really cutting relations? Gas is the single most important element in European-Russian relations, and it would be entirely logical that the Russians would have their finger on that button if the swift cutoff were cut to come to the fore in the European Parliament.
Dr. Papadopoulos, we're talking about the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Despite the souring of ties with the Kremlin, Germany is going ahead with the Nord Stream 2 project. On the issue, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said, quote, energy ties are almost the last bridge between Russia and Europe. The foreign minister, German foreign minister Heiko Maas, also said, we must not burn all bridges with Russia. Supporters of this pipeline say that it's an economic project, not a political one, and it shouldn't be used as leverage. What is your perspective on the issue?
Indeed. And therein lies the reason, the ultimate reason, as to why a severing in economic relations between the European Union and the Russian Federation is highly unlikely. On the other hand, a severing in political relations between Brussels and Moscow is possible, but I believe it is inconceivable that there would be a severing in relations between an economic severing in relations between the European Union and Russia. Why? Because Russia needs the European market, and in particular the German market, to export its natural gas to. That is absolutely critical to the Russian economy. And likewise, the vast amounts, the vast majority of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. And when it comes to Germany, Germany is heavily dependent on the Russian Federation for natural gas. If Russia turned off its gas supply to the European Union, then the European economy, and the German economy in particular, would almost collapse overnight. And how would ordinary Germans and Europeans be able to survive the autumn and winter months? How would they be able to keep warm in their homes when there is no longer Russian natural gas coming into the European Union? So Sergei Lavrov, who is not a member of Putin's inner circle, he is a messenger, albeit a very capable one, has issued an exceptionally stern warning to the European Union to refrain from issuing those two sanctions on Russia. And I believe that the Europeans and ultimately the Americans understand that if Russia did go ahead and sever all relations, political, but most important of all, economic, then the European Union would simply collapse. Where would Europe receive its gas from? How would European industry be able to function without Russian natural gas? So it is not in the interest for Russia to sever economic relations, and likewise, it is not in the interest for the European Union to no longer be in receipt of Russian natural gas.
Mr. Dovtarov, following up on what our guest in London just said, is Germany basically making Europe more dependent on Russia?
Well, as I said, it's confusing the issue to speak about Nord Stream 2 as raising Russian supplies of gas to Europe. It's raising Russian supplies of gas directly to Germany, that's correct. But it does not change the balance of Russian's contribution to the Europe-wide energy situation. It is simply removing Russian gas, or half of Russian gas supplied to Europe, from the fragile, politically vulnerable pipelines through Ukraine. It is in the interests of Russia to continue this, and the only purpose of Lavrov's warning was to remind them that Russia is not an insignificant country, is a major power, and must be treated with respect. It also was a reminder that the Russians take a very dim view of the whole Navalny promotion coming out of Europe. I think that we have to remember that within Russia's power structures within Russia's political elites, and not just Mr. Putin and his narrow circle, but within the whole Russian power structure, there is a feeling of relief that Mr. Navalny finally has been treated as he should have been treated 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
There is the feeling that in trying to appear reasonable and civilized and decent and law and respecting human rights, the Kremlin has given the wrong signals to the West.
All right, I'm going to have to jump in there.
Confused.
Apologies, sir, we're running short of time. Thanks to my guest, historian, journalist, and author, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, joining us from London. Also thanks to research fellow at American University in Moscow, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, joining us from Brussels. Also, special thanks to you for joining us on this debate. It's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Islamic Revolution returned democracy to the Iranian people and allowed the masses to vote on the future direction of their nation in a referendum and turning the nation into the Islamic Republic. According to official results, the people overwhelmingly voted in favor of an Islamic Republic, approved by 98.2% of eligible voters in Iran. We now present you an article in this regard written by Robert Carter. The piece is titled, Why the Muslim World Needs More Islamic Revolutions. Please stay with us for more of Robert Carter's article. Despite what Western media claims, Iranians have benefited tremendously from the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and other Muslim nations could too. Before the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, returned from exile in Paris to jubilant scenes in Tehran, Iran was a country plagued with many issues. In particular, the former regime of the Shah refused to distribute wealth to those most in need, and deprived millions of Iranians of the chance to have a better life. Just as is the case in many Muslim countries today, oppressive regimes with Western support are preventing their people from excelling. But why? So Western imperialists keep their goons in power and defend the regional interests of non-Muslim powers. Iran's Islamic Revolution liberated Iranians from sharing the same fate as many Arab peoples face today. The following are just a few areas in which Iran extinguishes itself thanks to the Islamic Revolution. Education. Education among women and poor class families was shockingly low before the Islamic Revolution. According to the World Bank's report, the age group of 15 to 95, only 36% of Iranians were literate in 1979, while the global average was 69%. Other research said illiteracy among Iranian women may have been as low as 17% at certain points. However, following the Islamic Revolution, illiteracy in Iran has been totally eradicated. Not only that, but Iran has even begun leading the way in the fields of science, arts, poetry, sports, cinema, and so on, with Iranians achieving noteworthy successes on the world stage. Whether it is winning medals at the Olympics, for wrestling or producing the first female mathematician to win a Fields Medal. Iran is producing significant talent thanks to the Islamic Revolution's emphasis on education for all. A self-reliant economy. Those countries who are hostile towards Islamic Iran would claim that the revolution damaged Iran's economy and isolated the Islamic Republic from the rest of the world. I can't deny that Iran has been the victim of a campaign of cruel and illegal sanctions, which produce hardship. However, the wise response to this challenge by Iran's revolutionary leadership was to invest in Iran's domestic abilities. Dubbed the resistance economy, Iran has become largely self-sufficient and is now capable of holding out against the economic terrorism which imperialist powers utilize. Many products and services Iranians produce domestically to avoid relying on foreign exports. The most recent example of this is Iran's quickfire work on two COVID-19 vaccines, which are currently in the human trial stage. The production of these vaccines by the hands of Iran's science and medical professionals will ensure Iranians don't have to rely on vaccines from hostile nations. Hence the ban on imports of British, American, and Israeli equivalents. Islamic democracy and constitution. Before 1979, Iranians were ruled by the dictatorial monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who was installed as the Shah in 1953, when the British and the Americans backed a coup d'etat which saw the overthrow of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh. The Islamic Revolution returned democracy to Iranians and even allowed the masses of Iranians to vote on the future direction of their nation in a referendum on turning the nation into an Islamic Republic. According to official results, the people overwhelmingly voted in favor of an Islamic Republic, approved by 98.2% of eligible voters in Iran. What followed next was a constitution which secured the rights of all Iranian citizens inside the country, including religious freedoms for all and the right to vote for women, two basic principles the former regime failed to enforce. Now Iranians can vote for their government, they can vote for their president and even their religious representatives, all thanks to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Domestic defense and the defense industry. Iran is currently ranked as one of the strongest military forces in the world, with Forbes ranking the Islamic Republic in the top 4 of their top 10 list of strongest West Asian military forces in 2019. Iran produces everything from its tanks, armored vehicles, and defensive ballistic missiles. They have a navy which includes Iranian-built ships, boats, and even submarines. The Islamic Revolution gave Iranians their freedom, integrity and democracy. Now it produces the elements needed for the protection of its people. Iran's military, particularly the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, has been accredited with defeating both Daesh terrorists and Al-Qaeda terrorists across the region, including in Iraq and Syria. Not a bad record, given that the Islamic Republic has never started a war since its inception. The list could go on, but my point has been made. So many of Iran's neighbors are in bad shape, and the reason for this stems from the fact that they are under the wing of non-Muslim imperialist powers, which don't have the region's best interests at heart. Poverty, corruption, and oppression are rife in the region and the world, particularly in the Arabian Peninsula, an area which lacks democracy, it lacks human rights, and security, despite the fact that the United States and Britain are close allies. When the oil runs out, how long will the Western-backed regimes in the Arab world last? That is a question which Iran doesn't have to worry about, because thanks to the Islamic Revolution, Iran is self-sufficient, Iran is well-defended and free. The sapling of the Islamic Revolution, nurtured by the blood of more than 60,000 martyrs, finally bore fruit after years of unrelenting and continuous struggle amidst the cries of independence and freedom. With the collapse of the oppressive monarchic system and the defeat of domestic tyranny, the Iranian people succeeded in annihilating the calculations, relations, and institutions of imperialism. The 1979 Islamic Revolution opened a new chapter in the history of resistance and mass popular revolutions in the world. The determinative characteristic of this revolution, compared to other uprisings of the world during the 20th century, is its ideological and Islamic nature. After experiencing the anti-despotic constitutional demonstration and the anti-colonial uprising for the nationalization of oil, the Muslim nation of Iran learned the invaluable lesson that the specific and essential reason for the failure of those uprisings was the non-doctrinal quality of the struggles. The alert conscience of the nation, under the precious leadership of the source of religious emulation, the exalted Grand Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, identified the necessity for following the path of an authentic, doctrinal and Islamic uprising. The uprising of the Iranian nation has been not only about Western exploitation of national resources, but rather an intersection of many different issues, such as discrimination, marginalization, and most importantly, from a broader perspective, the hostility of liberal imperialism in monopolizing force, justice, and truth to the benefit of the powerful. History evolves to resolve. It develops through a dialectical process for real to become rational and rational to become real. Thus, the Islamic society has become the physical manifestation of the spirit of the Islamic Revolution, as individual conscience has risen to its height against oppression and exceptionalism. That alone pretty much explains political Islam and sets the agenda for its foreign policy vis-à-vis an international society that up to its waist is in the stomach of neoliberal dominion. Now, for more than a century, communities are subordinated as periphery to the imperialist core. Neoliberalism advocates for a system of division of labor under which the West would contribute technology, or rich states' capital and market, and other nations' labor. Islamic Iran has been launching satellites into orbit quite for some time now. The imposition of imperialist borders has divided the people with the same history, culture and language as a divide and rule strategy. The Islamic Revolution has given them a supranational identity. If invasion, occupation and plunder objectively are judged as evil, in such a context resistance shouldn't be merely seen as a political necessity, but rather as a moral duty. Therefore, the Islamic Republic faces the task it ideologically is based upon, resisting oppression and defending the oppressed. The Islamic Revolution is young at 42 years old. A year after it was born, both superpowers of the then bipolar world order, the United States and the former Soviet Union, started backing the Iraqi dictator Saddam and his campaign of bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons of mass destruction he owned from the West. But the Islamic Revolution never bandwagoned with any superpowers. It withstood alone and defended its ideals with an unbelievable resolution. The Islamic Revolution changed the structure of international politics. Therefore, the faithful Iranian people believe there is no power nor strength except in Allah, the Lofty, the Great.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.